Hey, folks. Hey, folks. It's Michael Steele. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. Yes, it's me. Yeah, you know. Folks have been throwing a few rocks at me the last week because I think I pissed some people off. But, you know, that's what I do. That's what I do. What can I say? You can find us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn, or wherever you get your podcast on. We love it when you download us, so make sure you do that. You can find me on Twitter at Michael Steele, and you know, that's what we do. So just go there and let's have some fun. But before you do all that, I want to spend a little bit of time with this next brother who I think you guys are really going to enjoy. We were just talking a little bit and realized it's been 10 plus years since we've been knowing each other and working together. He is really one of the more insightful conservative slash libertarians I know out there. And I don't know if that's in this day and age, you got to be careful when you start putting people in boxes, but he runs the gamut of thought. He really thinks stuff out. And I think you're going to hear that and be pleasantly surprised by how he draws you in. His name is Michael Long. He's an accomplished writer, speechwriter, educator, and award-winning screenwriter and playwright. Stuff that, you know, when I first met him, I was like, really? I just thought you did comedy. But no, he does a lot. His career as a writer began while he was a graduate student in physics. Okay, you heard me. He started writing as a graduate student in physics. Who does that? Yeah, he does at Vanderbilt University when he started performing comedy. Now, I guess that kind of, I guess that was the stress reliever, right, Mike? You just like, okay, I can't deal with, you know, the inclined parabola anymore, so I'm going to go.
I got to have something.
But eventually, he became a house MC for one of the oldest comedy clubs in America. Which one was that, by the way?
That's Zany's in Nashville.
Oh, yeah, Zany's.
Coming on something like 40-something years now they've been there. Maybe more than that.
Well, he was the house MC for Zany's. His first job as a writer offstage was sole speechwriter to one of America's highest-profile senators. Mr. Long has written remarks for members of Congress, U.S. cabinet secretaries, governors, diplomats, businessmen and women, CEOs, presidential candidates, and a few lieutenant governors that I know. His new book, co-written with Daniel Z. Lieberman, M.D., is The Molecule of More. It's a great book. We're going to get into that, folks. You won't believe where they've gone with this book and why. It's not only exciting folks here in the U.S., but globally. We'll talk about that. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast, Michael. Good to have you, man.
Man of Steel. I love it. I love it. It's so good to be back with you, my friend.
It is. No, it's really good to get the old hookup going again. I really appreciate you, brother. Look, so this book, let's start there because I think this book, this conversation is good to have first before we get into the Cohen, Pyongyang, and Donald Trump and North Korea conversation, because it may help explain some of what we see going on in our modern day political environment. So this book, The Molecule of More, by you and Dr. Lieberman, really gets into some interesting aspects of the brain and human behavior, sexual activity, creativity. You guys talk about how a single chemical in your brain drives love, sex, and creativity and will determine the fate of the human race. So at least
we didn't pick a big topic.
No, you didn't. No, this is something we could discuss this over milk and cookies and just bring the kids in by the fireplace and we'll just there have the go. Conversation. So talk to me about what it is you guys discovered about the single chemical in our brain, which really seems to have a pretty impactful outcome.
Well, I'm happy to, and man, I just got to thank you again for having me. It's fun to talk to you, and that we get to record it and broadcast it is just a bonus.
Yeah.
This I know a lot of folks are listening just because they like to hear you, but a lot of folks are listening because this is about politics. And let me state up front that if you want to understand some basic things, some basic motivations about politics, especially in America, we explain them from a whole new perspective in this book, The Molecule of More. The chemical we're talking about is dopamine. Everybody's heard of dopamine, yeah. And they hear about it as the molecule of pleasure. Well, it turns out, if you dig into the research a little bit, that's not it at all. It's the molecule of more. It's the thing that makes us want. It's the thing that makes us pursue. It's the thing that makes us desire. And it's the thing that gives us the ability to calculate, plan, and analyze, and exercise cunning to get the things we want. And if you think about it, that begins to crack open a whole new way to consider consciousness and the way we go through the day. Briefly, it's like this. There are things that we anticipate, and there are things that we experience. You know, you look forward to Christmas, which is a different feeling from opening the presents. And that governs everything we do in life. And once you understand that, it cracks open all sorts of fields like politics and ambition and so on.
Interesting. Oh, I never looked at it. You're right. There is a different feeling anticipating Christmas than the actual day of opening the presents. So how would you describe that feeling after the day, like, you know, 6 o'clock that afternoon?
Well, I'll tell you, when you're
sitting there, you're like, damn, okay, I did all that. And all right, so how does that connect on the back end of it? Because I get the front end where you're like, wow, okay, on the first day of Christmas, you know, you kind of work your way up. And then you have that day where you do the presents. How does that other side of this equation play into it?
Well, let's look at it this way. I'll answer your question with questions whose obvious answers begin to point toward it. If you're having a good meal, oh, that tastes good, it smells good, it feels good in my mouth, you're enjoying the company of the person that you're with, you like the way their clothes look, you like the smell of the restaurant, the look, that's all experience, that's all in the moment, it's happening right now.
Right.
And there are a whole host of neurotransmitters, chemicals in the brain, we call them neurotransmitters, that conduct all this mental activity, and we'll call those the here and now chemicals. Very simple. But when you're anticipating something, looking forward to it, you're thinking, oh my goodness, I'm going to have a meal tonight. I'm going to see Michael Steele. Right. He'll have good stories. I'm going to eat good food. I can hardly wait to do that. I'm so looking forward to it. That feeling of anticipation is conducted by a single chemical in the brain, and that chemical is dopamine. Now, why should that matter at all? Well, it's because the feelings we get from those are very different. The desire, the drive for that anticipation, the desire to get to the thing, to pursue the goal, can be, in some people, quite strong, and much stronger even than the experience of something. And so that leads to these questions I'm talking about. Why do kids anticipate Christmas, but then 20 minutes later they're playing with the boxes instead of the toys? Why do we look forward to a vacation, and as soon as we're there, we're planning what we're going to do that night instead of enjoying the museum? Why is the ambitious business person, and this really is the kicker, why is the ambitious business person who's most able to afford a beach house the least likely to sit in that Adirondack chair and enjoy the view?
Yeah.
Some of us have high dopamine, and all we want to do is pursue. And if that's the case, we're not very very well equipped to enjoy the experience of something.
It comes
down to a chemical process.
Interesting. So how does that then play into this idea of, you know, our emotions, our fears, our morality, when you have these desires, and when you look at our current political landscape, and certainly some of the leading players on that landscape, you can say in some instances they've got too much dopamine because they're so overwhelmed with the idea of winning an election, pursuing that particular goal, that the actual act of governing is disappointing. And it's frustrating because there's nothing really to pursue there. I mean, it's a different type of pursuit. Is there a distinction in the kind of pursuit that could be impacted by those other emotions, fears, and this general sense of morality that's supposed to govern everything we do?
You know, Michael, you couldn't have set me up better if I had written that. That is such a great...
Well, this is what happens when you know a brother for a long time, right?
I appreciate it. Well, here's the thing. One of the things we did in this book is we were very careful to not take political sides, because in this environment, which you know better than anybody I am aware of, as soon as you hint that you're favoring one side or the other, it's very easy to discount everything they say. And so in our book, we were very careful to talk to both sides and just talk about the data. And here's what the data say. People who are self-identified as being on the left or liberal typically have higher levels of dopamine.
Really?
They typically have higher levels of dopamine. They have typically a slightly higher average intelligence score, in fact, as well. People who are self-identified as conservative tend to have we're not going to say lower dopamine, but they have higher here and nows. Now, what does that mean philosophically, practically? It means people on the left tend to take more pleasure from planning, controlling, working things out, figuring out problems. People on the right, with more here and now chemicals than dopamine, tend to want to conserve. Hence the word conserve. They want to save the things they have, enjoy the things they have, preserve what is there. So for all our talk about how we're reasoning creatures and our conclusions come from fact, in fact, there's a core level of, I'll call it orientation, that we both have. It's not to say we can't overcome it or that we're slaves to it, but we can say that we tend to orient ourselves toward either action and planning or conservation and appreciation. And that's the big philosophical difference driven by chemicals between the left and the right. And we can talk about how that plays out.
Well, no wonder the liberals want to spend all the money they don't have. Okay. that explains that drive. They got too much dopamine. They're out there. It's like just like I was just saying, oh, let's just pursue. Let's go. Let's spend and let's do it. No, I'm just having some fun. All my liberal friends who are listening are probably now just, you know, throwing the radio out the window. But but that kind of makes sense to me. Actually, more than makes sense to me, particularly given some of the people I've had to deal with over the years. So I guess that's in one sense why in today's climate we don't get the other. We don't get it, and they don't get us. In other words, because of the levels at which we come into the game, that pre-orientation is such that we just don't align ourselves where we kind of get what the other side is gunning for or where they're coming from, and they don't really seem to ever get where we're coming from with respect to our beliefs and how we view some of these issues. And so a lot of this has to do with that sort of dopamine effect.
Well, you're exactly right, and I don't want to overstate this,
right,
because
right.
I'm not saying that our chemicals in our brains determine our future and our political orientation completely. Not. We can choose to do something else. There are people who are conservatives with high levels of dopamine. There are people who are on the left with low levels of dopamine. I mean, we can talk about the mixes, like the so-called crunchy conservatives. There's
right.
an interesting mix right there. But what I am saying is that in the main, across our behaviors, we tend to favor either appreciation or anticipation, planning or experience. One or the other is a little bit stronger. And so we see, for instance, that if you're a conservative and you run for office, well, you read in conservative magazines, for instance, about the so-called growth of conservatives toward a more liberal position when they're in action. Well, you don't even need brain chemistry to tell you that. You just need it to set it up. If you're in a position where the thing that gets rewarded is action and not inaction.
Right.
Of course, you're going to, quote unquote, grow in office from conservative toward liberal, because the thing that gives you a reward is the thing that is what liberals do, which is use the government to achieve some end.
How does that change your, I mean, are you saying your philosophy changes? I mean, look, I in one sense, I can identify with what you're saying, because I know as a former elected official, my appreciation of government changed once I became a government official. And my perspectives of the role and the work that government plays and has in society evolved on that line. Is that what you're talking about? Because philosophically, the orientation was still pretty much the same. It was making government work more efficiently.
Yes.
You know, as opposed to a lot of conservatives just want to shut the thing down and eliminate the department. once you're in the room and you see all the levers and all the windows and doors and desks and you see how the thing comes together, and then a citizen comes into that room and goes, I need help. Your inclination then is not to shut down the government, but to make it work better. So is that part of that evolution for someone who would otherwise kill the department, or what? I guess I'm just trying to figure out how that marries up, because I don't know if you just all of a sudden become a liberal because you want to, you get a rush of dopamine one morning when you get up.
No, I'm not saying that at all. I'm not saying you get into office and or you go through the day and simply abandon your intellectual right. approach because you're dealing with these chemicals. No, but it is perhaps easier to understand from a philosophical perspective than it is from a chemical perspective at this point. If I put you in a room every day, and the only thing in that room is a red button that causes things to happen.
Right.
You're going to think about pushing that red button a lot more than not pushing that red button, because that's the only thing to do. Government rewards action.
Yes.
And if you, I mean, think about the times when you were Lieutenant Governor of Maryland, think about the times that you were in the news. It was most often when you did something, not when you said, let's not do something.
I probably said that more often.
That's the reward. And the brain works the same way. If you're highly dopaminergic, you get a rush of good feeling. And I'm greatly simplifying. I don't want to offend anybody.
Yeah.
I'm not saying anything other than this is how things tend to be in the main. There are always exceptions. There are people to whom this will not apply. But if you get a reward from doing something, you're going to do something more often to get that reward. If that reward is kind of low, you're not going to do things as often. And that's sort of a built-in bias in government itself toward leftism or liberalism, if you will. In fact, liberalism is a better term here, because that doesn't have quite the sweeping emotional terms of leftism. What I am saying that government is built to do things, not to not do things.
Yeah, that's true.
So it's naturally going to grow. It naturally makes sense. And it's going to naturally attract people who are highly dopaminergic, who like to do things because they get a reward from it emotionally.
So does that explain why you have, you know, sort of the diehard liberals out there and the hardcore conservatives, and they hold those positions regardless of the argument that comes into the room. And in some cases, instead of going towards pushing that button, they don't push the button to get something done. They just kind of stand in the corner of the room. What is that? How does that effect play out?
I think what it explains even better is our inability to understand across the aisle. If one side likes, let me tease that, Michael. I'm gonna ad hoc this, so I'm not going nowhere. So you stick with me, or have the edit button ready to go. if one side likes savory things and the other side likes sweet things, no amount of convincing is going to change the. And, you can tell them how good savory things are. The sweet people are going to like sweets,
right.
And the sweet people can talk about savory and so forth. Well, if the basic reward that you get in your consciousness is from action and planning, no amount of romance and benefit simply appreciating what something is, of sitting still, is going to turn that down. It may make the attraction greater,
right.
But it's not going to make it go away. So logic only goes so far. We're up against our very nature at its core when we try to tell the other side they ought to come over to us. If I say to if I'm a conservative and I say to a liberal, you ought to let things lay, you ought to let things stay and see how they work out on their own, which is a literal conservative position. The person on the left would say, well, we can take action and we can get things done and make it happen faster and better. Well, that makes perfect sense to someone who's rewarded chemically by action. And if you're on the left and you say, come on, let's go do something, let's take action right now. Well, if you're on the right, there's not as much appeal for that chemically. And that's how it plays out. And again, I'm greatly simplifying. But if you read the book, The Molecule of More, you're going to see that this applies to politics. It's easy to see in love, too.
Right.
This desire and how strong it can be compared to simply chilling out and waiting to see what happens. We're all familiar with how it feels to fall in love. I hope we are. God help you if you're not.
Right.
I hope everybody's familiar with that. And after the numbers say actually 6 to 18 months, that romantic love begins to fade. Why? Because dopamine begins to fade. Dopamine is an evolutionary chemical. It drives us to investigate new things. It wants us to find new things like food and shelter and reproductive partners so we can continue to propagate the species. That's what drives us forward. And as soon as we've investigated something to our satisfaction, dopamine begins to fade. So that's why dopamine does this in the first place, to drive us toward progress. And in love, you feel that dopamine rush to find out more about your new lover, your new potential lover. The more you learn about them, the less that dopamine feeling continues until it finally fades away because you know
all that there is. And then you become indifferent.
And you become indifferent. And all you're left with is a here and now chemical. That's why love changes from pursuit to appreciation. And you have to make that change.
Some people just skip right past appreciation to divorce court.
As soon as the thrill of the dopamine romantic chase is over.
Your Honor, I'm out of dopamine. What can I say? I'm sorry. I'm going to pay for this one.
But that's key. This is why, I almost wish I had started with this, because so many times when my co-author and I talk about this, we say dopamine is not just something that fell out of the sky. Evolutionarily, it makes sense. We have to have some drive inside us biologically that makes us seek out new things, because if we don't, we won't find food. We won't find shelter. We won't propagate the species. And dopamine makes us curious to find new things, and it gives us the ability to plan for those new things.
To what degree does this make our behavior somewhat predictable?
It makes it greatly predictable in many areas. I'll tell you one way we can talk about prediction is we can look at the levels of dopamine in somebody's brain. What we actually measure is the level of dopamine activity in a scanner. If we see that higher level of dopamine, we know that that person is, in the main, statistically, more of those people are going to be ambitious. Those people are going to be perhaps more given to, in certain cases, they could be more susceptible to gambling disorder. They're going to be more creative. The higher the dopamine level, the more activity there is to seek out new things and to try to make sense of them.
Yeah, so does it ever get to a point where the body, just regardless of what you're doing, you know, like you did discuss with the love thing changing over time to something else, the dopamine recede. Is there ever a point at, like, for example, as you age, where the production of dopamine just by the natural course of evolutionary physiology just decides, okay, you've had enough. I can't have an 80-year-old out here acting like they're 37.
That's a good question. That's a good question. And the answer is yes. Dopamine diminishes, or its activity diminishes as well, as you get older. Parkinson's disease, for instance, is in one way a diminished capacity for the employment of dopamine.
Oh, right.
So we see that. We also know that high dopamine activity can be associated with high creativity, and it can also be associated with mental illness. And if I can just take a minute, Michael, and kind of expand on that, because it's very interesting. You know, we talk a lot about people who are creative being crazy. We hear that,
right,
that awful term. And it turns out that a creative brain and a brain that might be associated with madness, those two kinds of brains are actually closer to one another than either are to a normal functioning brain. When you have high dopamine, one of the things that happens is you're a little more easily distracted. Things that might otherwise slip past your attention take your attention. And so as a result, your brain, your memory is more filled with different images, ideas, possibilities, just because you tend to pay attention to things that other people don't pay attention to. Now, if you are like that, that might make you creative. You would begin to associate things that other people don't associate. In fact, that's a great definition of creativity. It's the association of things that haven't typically been associated. Uh-huh. For instance, you think of the Bob Dylan song, Subterranean Homesick Blues. And I'll just give you a couple of the lyrics. It's Mama's in the bay, Johnny's in the basement, mixing up the medicine. I'm on the pavement, thinking about the government, man in the silk suit. You see, these are just seemingly random images thrown together, but taken out in this context, they are interesting and artistic, and we like them. That, however, is about one step removed from what psychiatrists call word salad. Word salad is what you hear from, for instance, a schizophrenic, someone who is so overwhelmed with these ideas that they can't control how they come out. So whereas Bob Dylan gives us Johnny's in the basement mixing up the medicine, a schizophrenic might say, scaffolding, school bus door, walk to mama, there it is, there right. it is, why not? And you see, they're very similar in their construction and their source, but they're wildly different in their effect. And so madness, if you will, is a term of art, madness and creativity are actually two branches of the same tree.
Interesting. Well, that may explain the behavior for some folks I know.
Well, just a little, enough dopamine, creative, too much dopamine, madness. And we see this over and over. Artists like Brian Wilson of the Beach Boys, for instance, who has spent his whole life walking that line and actually has dealt with mental illness, but the creativity that he gave us. And I won't go through it here, but we can go through a chapter and
well,
verse.
Yeah, we've heard of
things. Amazing.
Yeah, we've heard about it, you know, with guys like Mozart and Beethoven, all these guys, you know, got to, you know, Van Gogh and, you know, cutting off your ear and all this other stuff. And then you're like, oh, my God, that's an amazing masterpiece. But you only have one ear. What happened? You know, so, I don't know. I painted the mountain and the next thing I heard a voice say, cut off your ear. I don't know. So the book is The Molecule of More. By Daniel Lieberman and my good friend Michael Long, who's in the house with us right now. So let's translate all of that to something that's a little bit more gritty and even harder to understand. What we see playing out today, sort of the chemical, some would say, imbalance that our politics has wrought. In terms of how some of these actors out here are kind of moving around. Does this principle, this idea of the molecule of more dopamine, explain not just Donald Trump as a phenomenon of in and of himself, but how people respond to him and seemingly connect to him in a way that, I think a lot of folks, myself included, would consider to be unusual, particularly when you consider some of these same folks didn't even have this same level of degree and passion for Ronald Reagan that they seemingly do for someone like Donald Trump. How does that chemically work, if you will? What drives that and makes that? It's got to be more than, oh, gee, lock her up. You know, and the people go, oh, my God, I've never heard of such a profoundly important thing. You know? I don't understand. I'm so confused.
Well, I think, you know, I don't want to stretch the dopamine idea to the point that it breaks.
Right. I'm not asking you to do that. And I don't want to do that. Right. Because I know that's not realistic, nor is it. Does it connect necessarily that way? But there's got to be some rational explanation.
I think in broad strokes, Michael, I think we can say that if you set aside the particulars of policy, and you say let us consider people on the left or Democrats, we'll just say, and to be folks who in the main think the answer to most problems is action. Okay.
Right.
I don't think too many Democrats would disagree with that. They say, well, we need to do something. I think people on the right, the Republican Party, might say, you know, let's wait. Let's see how things work out with people doing their own thing on
right.
this. That's an inoffensive way to put both sides. Well, that's nothing more than an expression of what we know chemically, that people on the left tend to have more dopamine than people on the right. So the more we amplify that difference, the more threat both sides feel. If the answer to everything is change, well, of course, those who cling to, I'm not gonna use that word, cling. I got somebody in trouble once. Those who look to conserve the life and the way of life they have, and the habits they have, the patterns they have, the culture they have, of course they're going to be threatened when constant change is thrust upon them. And then on the other side, people who seek to, the word progressive, to make progress, to change the world, they're going to see people who are more wait and see in their attitude, not just as mistaken, but as barriers to the progress of the world itself. And so this outlook on the world's policy set aside, this outlook on the world is amplified, especially by technology and the ease with which we can share our perspectives. I think that is one way to look at what's going on right now. This abject hostility is not just about policies. It's rarely about policies. It's about how we see the world, and to a great extent, how we see the world is governed by our genetics.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I've been giving a number of talks around the country in the last few months, and you know, if anybody wants me, you know, have a conversation, just call me. But one thing,
we should go out together. That's what we should.
That'd be a lot of fun. That would be a lot of fun. But you touch on a very interesting point for me, because I typically at some point during my conversation or my talk or speech, whatever, make the point that we are where we are because this is where we want to be, and that we as a broader society, irrespective of how you voted in 2016 or even really how you feel right now about the nature and state of our politics, that there are elements of what's going on that you actually deep down are okay with and may even agree with. And that part of discovery for me is fascinating, because really where it came home just literally a couple of days ago, I was talking with someone who is a Democrat, right? I would say maybe not progressive, but a strong liberal. And she said to me at one point in our conversation how Donald Trump had done something. I was trying to remember the context of what it was, and she said I had to catch myself because I was actually finding myself agreeing with him, and it got me thinking more and more about that sense of, you know, you've got the exterior repulsion. Oh my God, there's no way in hell I just can't. But then when you step back, there's an interior acceptance or a more close alignment on an issue or a statement or even a tweet than people are ready to admit publicly, which is why I still contend that this vote in 2020 is not a foregone conclusion against Donald Trump, that he touches and has reached more people than are willing to admit that they actually like his policy on X, Y, or Z, or agree with his statement on A, B, and C. You know what I'm saying? There's a weird dynamic, I think, out there in the public. And there are a lot of things that are driving that.
Well, you know, it's interesting you say that, Michael, because one of the studies we cite in our book boils down to this. People who are more liberal are less reactive to provocation than people on the right. And what I mean in particular.
Don't we know that?
Yeah, we've measured it, we can see it. Is that, you know, if you make some sort of threat toward people on the left, they tend to move along with it. People on the right tend to go for the mattresses, as
right.
they say.
Right.
And so I think, you know, if I were advising, and I mean this sincerely, if I were advising somebody on the left how to win in 2020, I'd say this. I'd say, quit sticking your thumb in the eye of the people in the right. You're just making it worse and worse and worse. The more calm you are about it, the more conciliatory you are. You don't have to give up a thing about what you believe, but you can't you can't come at it by telling them first you're wrong and let me tell you why. It's like I say when I'm a speechwriter. I teach speech writing all over the place, all over the world, literally. And one of the things I say when I talk about persuasion is nobody ever won an argument by starting with, "Hey, stupid."
But wait a minute. That is so true. But Donald Trump started his argument with, "Hey, all you Mexicans are rapists and murderers."
Right, and that
and
is
yet going, that worked. What was that all about?
I don't think that's why he won. I don't think that's why he won.
No, I'm not saying that's why he won, but come on, dude. That, I mean, to your point, you'd think that if you started a conversation with, "Hey, stupid," the next thing you hear is someone either walking away or the sound of their book upside your head.
But that's not the only factor in play. Think about it. You're familiar, of course, with the Flight 93 essay.
Yes.
And if there are people on the right who feel that this was a Flight 93 election, then you're going to
explain that to folks, the Flight 93.
The Flight 93 is that if you don't do something now, right this minute, that you will die. Right. And the Flight 93 election idea, written by a man named Michael Anton, I believe, was that if Hillary Clinton had won in 2016, that would have been basically the end of the kind of America that conservatives know, that this was now or never. And so if that's how you feel, and I know and you know a lot of conservatives feel that way, you're going to put up with a whole lot of stuff from the person who might save you from it. And you might be especially attracted to someone who sticks his thumb in the eye of the other side.
But even if that person who's saving you from what you think is the worst thing possible, in the meantime, is moving you into something that could be the same or even worse.
Yes, and that's in the future. What you're worried about is right now. The immediate feeling is what's in front of you.
Right.
That's what's it.
You just connected the dot. There you go.
I mean, think about this. If you and I are, let's say you and I are out in a boat in the middle of the ocean, as we often are, of course.
I live there, yes.
Out in a rowboat in the middle of the ocean, and I say, "Hey, Michael, let's drink some of this water." And you'd go, "Well, that's crazy, because that water will kill us because of the salt." Well, 2 or 3 weeks pass and we're without water. You know what we're eventually going to say? Well, you know, it couldn't hurt. Let's try.
That's true.
Future threats are a little match for current feelings. It's like when you're a candidate or when you're talking to candidates, if the other guy says, "We can't afford this and we can't afford that and it'll wreck our budget," all you have to do is say, "Ladies and gentlemen, everything my opponent said may be true, but look at this starving child." Immediacy changes everything.
Right. That you just connected a dot, and I think for a lot of folks, in terms of explaining the conservative culture of Trump, and that's why that argument, "I'm fighting for you, I'm going to build the wall," because that solves what people perceive to be an immediate problem, even if it isn't in real life a problem, to be honest. I mean, that's one of the bigger debates, and why when people turn that corner on, you know, the fact that you can throw the statistics out that illegal immigration is net zero for the last 3 or 4 years. It's down overall. There aren't these massive caravans coming across the border, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that, you know, drug interdiction is not at the border, but at points of entry for the country, a la an airport, LAX, New York, LaGuardia, but that immediate sense of concern and panic overrides whatever that factor, that logic is, because it's not meeting that particular concern.
Yes, yes. And if you think the press has nothing to do with it, think again. And I'm going to pull a surprise here and say, I'm not talking about whether the press is favoring the left or it's actually fair or whatever.
Right.
Think about the fact that what they put on the news is, and I'm not saying this in a negative way about them, I'm saying what they put on the news is what we are told are the problems, and that's what we assume the problems are. Now, look at the things that we worry about today. They're all about anticipatory things, things in the future. Look at the problems that people considered before there was a mass media. They had to learn about issues by going face to face with the people who were going to be speaking. You know, we know that that in Lincoln's time, even as recently as that, they would go and sit through a 6-hour talk yeah. with somebody because that's the only talk they were going to have with this person. Right. And they'd hear about the issues that way. They didn't have a mass media to pick things up for them. So we are driven toward the problems we are told are problems. And that's not necessarily out of bias, although it could be. It's not necessarily out of some nefarious desire, though it could be. But it does mean that we are concerned with what's in front of us, and the press has a mighty power that way.
Well, you touch on a subject. I teach at Brown University a seminar on the branding of American politics and the deconstruction of that same politics by, you know, the political parties, etc. And one of the things that I talk about is, and we just had our first seminar this past week. Is, you know, the times we're in right now, Michael. Everyone thinks, oh my God, this is the worst it's ever been, and you know. It's so this, it's so that, and I try to point out, well, no, actually, let's look at the election of 1800, you know, between Jefferson and Adams, which was not a pretty campaign. Let's look at, you know, Aaron Burr killing, Hamilton over a personal dispute having to do with Aaron Burr's father-in-law, you know, so it's amazing. The difference is twofold, I think, and you put your finger on the core of those of that is one, our politics is much more personal today than it has ever been. And the reason it is much more personal is number two, media. Back in the day of our founders, when an event happened, when a speech was given, it took weeks, if not months, for the general public to become aware of it, let alone understand what it was, particularly given the fact that most people could not read. So you had this vacuum of information that was largely consolidated to a smaller group of the population, largely landed gentry, white men. Today, you know, if this broadcast can be downloaded in a nanosecond and listened to by 3,000 people. We'd like to get the number up to around 4. So come on with us, folks. You know, help us out here.
And buy a book for Pete's
sake. And buy the
Molecule of More.
Yeah, that's your goal. Two-time homework assignments here. Download the podcast and buy the book. But all of that happens instantaneously. So opinions are formed. Impressions are made. Decisions are you know, locked in. In that very, very short period of time. And so it almost as if the dopamine doesn't even have a chance to really, you know, kick in because we're now pre-programmed to react in a way because of the instantaneous nature of information. And the media puts that stuff out there and we create our own media as well, our blogs and websites and other things that further that argument.
Well, we can see the power of dopamine and then metaphorically all the things it touches on. But when we think about our obsession with our phones, most of us are loath to set that phone aside. We get it out, we look at it, we see if there's something new on there. It's because every time we check, we're feeding that little dopamine hit. Dopamine is telling us there might be something new around the corner. That's what dopamine does. It encourages us to look for new things. Well, there might be a little ding. You hear that ding walking down the street in your phone, you get it out. That might be something good. That might be from a friend. It could be email. It could be a fun message. It could be a picture. Who knows what it is?
Right.
Or when you're scrolling through something like Facebook, which has what's called an infinite scroll. It goes on and on and on. There's no point where it says stop and go back to work, and you continue to go. Did you ever think about why you continue to scroll down that Facebook page? It's because there may be something good just around the corner,
right.
And that's that dopamine feeling that's saying, come on, keep looking. There may be something new, and when you get there, you have it. Maybe you're happy, or maybe you're not, but the point is dopamine's always going to encourage you to continue to look.
And that it does. Michael Long, he's one of a kind, folks, and I really appreciate you stopping by the podcast today, hanging out with the man of steel, as we like to say, here at the Michael Steel Podcast. Good luck with the book. This is not just a national sensation. This your book is taken off globally now, I understand, as well, right?
That's right. It is available, or will be available eventually, in a total of 10 countries, in 9 languages. It'll be in Russia in March. It'll be in Poland in April. It'll be in Romania in May. It's already in Germany. And I'm not sure if the Japanese version is out or not. The
Morogato Kazama.
Listen to you. You're a fancy talker. The Japanese, the German version is called, I think the title is One Hormone to Rule Them All, which is kind of an echo.
That's so typical Japanese.
Lord of the Ring thing. But yeah, it's available all over the world. It's published by Ben Bella. You can find it at Amazon and any of the international Amazon sites. It's done really well. We'd love to get it out there to more people. And I'm so grateful for you, Michael. I mean, just this is like going to lunch only without a bill. This is right. Good. This is just like the conversations we've always had.
Absolutely. So, well, you can follow Michael on Twitter at Mike Writes, right. And that's WRITES. And certainly check out the website MikeLongOnline.com, and probably follow links there on that site to Amazon and other fine establishments to get a copy of the book. And it's a good one, folks. The Molecule of More, brought to you by Michael Long and his partner, Daniel Lieberman, MD. Best success, man, to you guys. And thanks again for coming on.
My pleasure.
Just want to just raise one little thing with you. You know what happens to most of us at some point or another? Debt just sort of creeps up on you. You know how that is? How many of us have looked at our finances and screamed, "How can we make this much and still have so much debt?" Unexpected repairs, replacing the washer and dryer, medical bills, and of course the killer, those insane interest credit cards you had to use to pay for it all, right? Here's a really smart move that could help you get on top of your finances. Get a fixed rate personal loan at bestegg.com. The rates are great right now. Now imagine finally being able to pay down those crazy high credit cards and bills and then bank the money you save each month. Consumers have rated Best Egg 4.8 out of 5 stars on Consumer Affairs because of the super easy online app that takes about a minute with no impact to your credit score. Upon approval, funds can be deposited in as little as one business day. So get your bills under control. Bank what you save. And take control of your finances with a loan from BestEgg.com. Visit BestEgg.com/plan. That's BestEgg.com/plan. All right, folks. All right, guys. Now, be sure, don't forget, you know, you got to go to Stitcher and tune in and Apple Podcasts. Download as much as you can. Spread the word. We're out here on the street always trying to keep it real and have some fun at the same time. This is Michael Steel. Catch you next time.